thought about talking about gratitude, since that's on my mind. I talked about that on Monday. I thought about talking about impermanence, since this is a good time to talk about it. But what I'd like to at least start off in talking about is as if this was like my last chance to give a talk. You know, like last chance here in Palo Alto. Like, so what's the most important thing I could say? Absolutely the most important thing I could say, given this my last chance to teach people in Palo Alto. What would it be? Well, I wonder. But that's kind of more of the spirit in which, you know, I want to talk. And I guess I could use a lot of things I could say just with that as the direction for the talk. But what I want to say to begin with is the practice of mindfulness is both very simple and very liberating. And both those qualities are something that needs to be appreciated, or, you know, can be appreciated. And appreciating them both bring a lot of joy about this practice. The simplicity of it is that very little is asked of us in doing this practice. And all we're asked to do is to notice what is happening in the present moment. What's happening right now? We're not asked to adjust or manipulate what's happening in the present moment. We're not trying to get a better present moment or protect ourselves in the present moment. It's just a very simple act of noticing what's happening in the present moment. What happens to many of us is that our life is not that simple. That in our relationship to the present moment is characterized by often a lack of acceptance, often by an attempt to hold on to something, often characterized by various ways in which we're trying to build up a sense of self in the present moment, or protect a sense of self, or avoid having a sense of self. Hopefully no one sees me here, and we protect ourselves in some way. And there's a lot of doing that goes on in our lives. And some of that time, this doing quality of many of our lives is very chronic. Even people who are doing nothing physically, they don't go to work, they're not talking to anyone, they go and come to a meditation center, and they sit down at 7 o'clock to sit and do nothing, are sometimes shocked by how much doing goes on in their mind. Not any of you, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing happened, right? But it's really amazing how much doing goes on in the mind. Planning, remembering, rehearsing conversations that have happened, you know, improving on them, fantasizing, trying to defend oneself, build oneself up, trying to justify oneself, judging oneself, judging other people, lost in ideas of desire, lost in ideas of planning, lost in ideas of aversion, of what one doesn't want. The mind can be very, very active, doing. And what we want to do in mindfulness is to realize how simple mindfulness is in and of itself. Mindfulness itself isn't involved in all those kinds of doings. It's not meant to be. It, in a sense, it's the antidote to all those doings. It doesn't mean necessarily you have to stop doing all those things. You have to realize that mindfulness itself is not the doing. It's kind of like your television screen is not the show. The television screen holds the show on television, and you can change channels and you get a different show. But the tube is just the tube that holds it all. And the tube is what it is. It's kind of very simple in a sense. It just kind of reflects what's being projected. Maybe a better analogy is the mirror. Whatever the mirror reflects can be very simple or very complex. But the mirror itself is always very, very simple. The mirror itself doesn't judge, it doesn't criticize, it doesn't hold on to anything, it doesn't expect things to be different, it doesn't want things to be different, it doesn't want things to stay the same. The mirror just reflects what's there, somewhat accurately, right? What's there. Mindfulness is kind of like a mirror in its raw simplicity. It's that simple. And to realize that we have part of us, a capacity within us, some little, maybe for some of us, a little corner, back corner, someplace within us that can have that simplicity of being that just recognizes what's happening right now is a big part of what this practice is about. For some people, it's a revelation to realize there's a little corner of who they are that has that capacity. Because most of the time we're living in that part of our mind which is always doing something, manipulating or changing or reacting to our experience. So by finding that little corner, the mirror-like corner, it starts shifting our identity, our sense of where home is, where our residence is, where our refuge is for our life, away from all the doing and manipulation and reactivity that can be, into something which is non-reactive. And as we kind of appreciate that, that little corner begins to grow, and begins to grow, and becomes a more significant part of our life. So much so that you can be, someone could say something to you, where normally you would react quite strongly, but you're taking refuge in this capacity to be spaciously aware in that place of your mind, your heart, which doesn't react. It doesn't mean you're foolish about it. It doesn't mean you don't see what the person's doing, you don't do the appropriate thing. But you don't, your identity, your place of security, your place of refuge, your place of where you feel at home, is in no way touched by what's going on in the world. There's an awful analogy that the Buddhist scriptures use for this. And so this is, you know, kind of a parental guidance recommended analogy from the Buddha. And if you take a dead cow and you skin it, you get a really expert butcher that kind of knows how to just kind of skin that hide off just really well, just glides in there and pulls the hide off. And then you put that hide back on the same carcass. It'll fit just right, because that's where it came from. However, it's never going to be connected again. When mindfulness becomes a place we take refuge, we're still completely connected and involved in the world. The world still fits. We're still part of the world. But there's a kind of independence in the middle of it. There's both a kind of intimacy and a kind of independence. But there's a real independence where you feel that your place where you feel at center in yourself is a place of equanimity, of peace. Because mindfulness in and of itself has qualities of peacefulness and that it's not tied up in reactivity. Now, what we learn, so and one of the great things you can realize with mindfulness is that in that mindfulness you're simply recognizing what's happening now. What's happening now? At some point you might realize that mindfulness can be aware of anything that you can experience. Anything in the world of experience can be known by mindfulness. Which means that anything in the world of experience, any kind of situation you find yourself in, can, at least in theory, be met by non-reactive, peaceful presence. By that corner of the mind, that part of the mind, that part of the psyche, which is like a mirror, very peaceful. When I first realized this, I was on retreat, long retreat, and I realized the implications of this. I got really happy. Because I saw the possibility of being free in all situations. No matter where the situation is, I could be mindful of it, and the mindfulness, when it's really straight and clear, there's freedom right there. So mindfulness is very simple. What's complicated often is all our doings. What's complicated is often our identity, our self-identity, who we need to be, who we don't want to be. And mindfulness, because it's so simple, tends to slowly wear down all the doing. Because when you start paying attention carefully to what's happening in the present moment, you realize the cost of a lot of this kind of reactivity and self-building and manipulation and pushing away and holding on, the cost that has in your life. And it's draining. One of the definitions of an enlightened person in Buddhism is a person who no longer has any drains. that nothing drains their energy anymore. And there's no outflow. Another translation is no outflows. I like the word drain, you know, no longer a drain. We talk about the people being a drain, right? Have you ever paid attention to your own mind? And how a drain it can be? So someone enlightened has plugged up all the drains or no longer is inclined to that kind of activity. So mindfulness tends to slowly wear down because we realize the cost of clinging, of reacting, and it's a lot more satisfying to reside in a place of non-reactivity. So the simplicity of mindfulness tends to slowly wear down the unnecessary complications by which we live our lives. So I believe that mindfulness helps us, leads to a greater simplicity of being as we go about our life. Now, one of the ways to practice mindfulness practice is to keep it really simple, so simple that you understand that what mindfulness is a practice of not doing. Beyond just simply the knowing of what's happening in present moment, it's a practice of radical non-doing and ferreting out all the tendencies for the mind to do anything at all, and letting go of that doing. Any attempt to do anything, just let go. Just don't do, don't do, don't do. And it's very challenging because the mind always wants to do something, wants to adjust and react and judge and manipulate, but not to do. Now, for meditators, this can be very challenging because sometimes meditators are trying to change themselves as they meditate. They're trying to get calm, they're trying to get concentrated, they're trying to make themselves simple, they're trying to abide in simple mindfulness, there's always trying going on. And what you might try doing is every time you notice a trying, stop trying. Let go of your trying. Just unconditionally, absolutely, thoroughly let go of all your trying. All you're doing. So the meditation becomes a radical practice of non-doing. Not doing anything at all. This can be very, not only challenging, but very depressing, of course, to some of us, who think that the only thing that kind of will make our life worthwhile living is if we do something to make it better, to improve on it. It can be misunderstood, this non-doing. If a person is depressed, then non-doing just seems to be justified kind of hanging out in this low-grade kind of depressed state. But non-doing that's really non-doing, but depression is a kind of a doing. It's often they don't see it, that they're actually doing something often, unless it's a physiological cause for the depression. The doing. If we let go, boredom is a doing. You think boredom is just built into the situation. The situation is boring. But there's a kind of a doing that you're doing that in order to be bored, you have to do something. Actually, there's a very subtle aversion that you're doing. If you don't do anything at all, if you learn how to do nothing, you won't be bored. It's impossible. You won't be depressed. But you have to do it thoroughly. Not to do. Not doing. So one of the ways that Buddhists will sometimes practice meditation is they practice non-doing. And when they do it that way, they don't like calling it meditation. Because meditation sounds like something you're going to do. I'm going to meditate. Sometimes they'll say, rather than saying, I'm doing meditation, they'll say, I'm being meditated. Because you're being done too. And that's okay. It's okay to be done too. But any attempt for you as the agent trying to make something happen, you let go of. You let go of the attempt to try to control the situation, to improve on the situation, to do anything at all. And if you do that, you'll be done too. Part of you'll be done too, you'll engage yourself in a process of change because the edifice of much of the way we live our lives is built on a non-acceptance of the present moment. And when you pull out the non-acceptance and practice radical acceptance of the present, then the whole structure begins to dissolve and fall apart, unravel. And that might take, for some people, months or years of unraveling. But slowly, sometimes it happens faster, sometimes it happens faster, sometimes slower. But it begins to unravel. So there is a process of change that can go on, but you're being done too, rather than you causing the change. One of the reasons why both the mirror-like quality of mindfulness and this non-doing is so deeply satisfying is, on one hand, all our suffering that the Buddhists are trying to address, the suffering that arises out of clinging, is arising out of doing something, clinging. And if you don't cling, then you won't have the suffering that arises out of clinging. So one of the main purposes of Buddhist practice is to free you of suffering. So non-doing lets you discover this realm of non-clinging and the happiness that can arise from that, the lack of suffering. So then the question is, so I'm really emphasizing how simple it is. It's really simple, the practice of mindfulness. And if it's not simple, it's not mindfulness. It can be very difficult. But it isn't difficult because it isn't simple. Some people say, mindfulness is really simple. What's difficult is remembering to do it. And, you know, you'll find how, you know, you go a long time, many, many minutes, maybe sometimes before you remember to wake up in the middle of your sitting. What's difficult is the challenge of really wrestling sometimes with our tremendous momentum of doing, of wanting, of averting, of resisting. And sometimes the mind will set up all kinds, you know, sometimes the mind becomes a world-class lawyer, giving all the right reasons why you shouldn't let go, or why you need to have this, or why this is supposed to happen, or whatever. So you have to deal with that, you know, with the lawyer. You weren't trained in law, so it's quite hard to deal with all the logic that that corner of the mind can kick up. But then you just keep practicing non-doing, taking refuge there in the mirror-like quality of awareness. This is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. One of the things the lawyers will say is, it can't be good enough. It can't be enough to do nothing. To just dwell like a mirror, isn't that kind of inhuman? Isn't it kind of, what about my passion? What about my love? What about my compassion? What about my hobbies? You know, what about all the things that I do? What about helping my neighbors? And what about all these things that go on? You know, to be like a mirror, it sounds like I'll become just kind of like a zombie. And there's no, I lose my humanity. And all these fears come up. It's very interesting to explore all the fears that come up when we are offered the opportunity to practice non-doing. And in responding to this, I'll respond to in the way which people want to defend anger. I give a fair number of talks about anger, and inevitably someone will respond and say, anger has a place in my life, it's very important, because it motivates me to get things done. Unless I got angry or irritated, I wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't have the passion to kind of fight for justice or to change something. And that could well be, but sometimes when I hear these people talk about this, my response, or my how I see it, is that there's another very equally, if not even more powerful, motivator, and that is compassion. And it's a little bit sad to me that a person would justify anger as being the motivator when they have compassion as maybe even a much better and more healthier motivator that can actually get them to do the same thing with much passion. So the criticism that mindfulness, the mirror-like mindfulness, or the practice of non-doing is going to make you inhuman, it's going to lose part of who you are, I would say it's the opposite. That as we do less, that the natural responses to life begins flowing through us much more cleanly. Compassion is considered so intimate a part of non-reactive awareness that some in some Buddhist traditions are considered inseparable. And compassion brings forth a lot of then motivation to act and do things in the world. But that action and doing in the world comes from this place of non-doing. It's kind of like the natural response of an open heart. And it's possible that a lot of our responses from the world can be responses arising out of this emptiness of non-doing, instead of arising out of the complicated crowdedness of our reactivity, of our fears, of our judgments, of our desires. And this to me is one of the more remarkable aspects of practice that I discovered. And that is that the more I trust awareness, the more I trust resting in awareness, in a sense not doing anything, the more there seems to bubble up inside of me a tremendous intelligence. I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say tremendous. that's the wrong word. But a kind of intelligence, a kind of... It's not always right. But it's much brighter than the other one. There's this intelligence of knowing how to respond. Some people would call it intuitive. That seems to bubble up out of that place. So one of the things I practice and learn is trusting the awareness, trusting the mirror-like awareness, trusting that my job is to come back to that place of non-doing, of non-reactivity, of clearly seeing what's going on. And not, if I cling to that as the ideal or as my savior or something, then that very clinging, I think, will inhibit the natural flowing. But there's a natural flowing that comes out of an open heart. And sometimes in Buddhism it says, it's what flows out of emptiness. Practice brings us to helps us discover what emptiness is, and to trust that, and then life flows from that. Now, one of the reasons why this can be very, very frightening to people, because to trust awareness means you're trusting something which is different than your concept of self. And most people orient themselves in life and try to make security for themselves in life by some kind of self concept that they built up or defending or whatever. And not to have that can be very frightening. So sometimes there's a transition period where you have to deal with that being kind of wobbly. You think, well, gee, you know, I can't do that. You know, that's kind of frightening. I feel very vulnerable. But to take that transition time, and then, you know, the analogy that Jack Kornfield uses is like, if you don't know how to swim, I don't know if it's a very good example, but you fall in the water in a lake, and at first you crash about because you're afraid. And then at some point you realize all you have to do is relax and the water will hold you up, more or less. You're in the Dead Sea, at least. and it's kind of like that sometimes. You know, we fall into the sea of emptiness, sea of non-doing, and then we start trashing about because we're afraid. And then eventually we learn to relax, to trust. And that trust is one of the really important qualities that comes from practice, a radical trust in awareness, trusting awareness, trusting a presence, just being present. Some people like to say just being present. There was a beautiful transmission that I got from my Zen teacher, Mel Weitzman. And many years after he gave me this little transmission, he told me, maybe he'd even forgotten he'd done this or something, but he told me that he'd been told the same thing by his teacher, by Shunryu Suzuki, and it had a big impact on him. It was lovely, I think, to feel it had a big impact on him. When he said it to me, it had a big impact on me. We were driving across the Golden Gate Bridge. He was driving me across the Bay Bridge in about 1977. And in his old, little old Volkswagen Bug. And we were talking, and he said to me, "Just to be alive is enough. Just to be alive is enough." That's kind of like, you don't have to do anything to have enough. Just to be alive is enough. Now you might think that's very nice when life is pleasant and joyful and everything's going well. But what about when life is not going well? What if you're really sick or have some kind of crisis in your life? Is it enough just to be alive then? It often doesn't feel that way, but it can feel that way. And I think that if you have taken refuge, or if you found the power of this mirror-like awareness, this non-reactive presence, that little corner, that little capacity that's in you, if that has grown and developed and blossomed, the stronger and more blossomed that has developed, the more that becomes a resource at times of crisis. You won't forget that that's partly who you are. And you won't be overcome as dramatically as you would otherwise by the difficulties. Non-reactive awareness. Just to be alive is enough. So that's what I had to say tonight. Hopefully that made some sense for you. And hopefully you'll maybe experiment a little bit with doing less in your meditation, at least in your meditation. So your comments and reactions or responses?
Could you review that part about halfway through when you said there's meditation, then there was Buddhists who do a state they call meditative, where they're not meditating, they're just being.
Right.
And is that then just sitting and doing nothing but letting the mind flow? But if you are being mindful of it, you're sort of meditating.
Right.
What can you tell more about that? That interests me.
Well, some people will practice non-doing, and they don't want to call it meditating because meditating sounds like a technique in which you're applying yourself in some activity and doing. And they won't even practice mindfulness. But what happens is if you practice non-doing, if you notice every tendency you do and you're very thorough, then what's left is mindfulness. Because mindfulness is actually a natural capacity of the mind, the knowing capacity of the mind. And I believe, my experience is it gets clearer and clearer in that case. So you don't have to even apply the mindfulness. It arises by itself. Some people will practice non-doing, and they don't want to call it mindfulness. They don't want to call it meditation. So like in the Zen tradition, they don't like calling, sometimes they don't like to call what they're doing meditation. They call it sitting. And why they call it sitting is because physically, that's what they're doing, and they're not doing anything else. They're just sitting. It's called just sitting. That's the Soto Zen, the definition of the word they use. The Japanese word is shikantaza, which is the definition of what they're doing, means just sitting.
Why do that? Aside from meditation, and I sometimes like to. Well, actually, I heard on some tape a long time ago, the guy said, before I knew about meditation, he said, go sit for an hour, not drinking coffee or doing anything. Just sit and don't try to solve any particular problem. Just see what happens, see what comes to your mind. in 45 minutes will go by of sort of chaos, yeah. and then a solution to something would come. And the idea was you would just not be looking for anything, not trying, not anything particular.
Yeah.
So I still do that.
Great.
But yeah, the mindfulness helps, because then I'm more mindful when I notice
doing
what's going on then.
Yeah, so mindfulness is very helpful because you notice you're doing then. And what happens is as you get more settled and more concentrated and more able to look more carefully, you'll notice more and more subtlety about how you're always doing. So like you said, is practice just simply to let the thoughts flow by? In a sense, it would be. Except if you're very sensitive, you'll notice that embedded in many of those kinds of thoughts is a very subtle form of doing. Thoughts can arise just peacefully by themselves without any real sense of doing. But most thinking that we have, it has some kind of doing as part of it, some reacting and responding to something.
Planning,
yeah. And so initially you practice this non-doing to thoughts, but if you're very mindful of what's actually going on there, you'll see that there's a doing there. And so at first we let go of the coarsest doing, and then as the practice settles, you can notice the more and more subtle, until perhaps finally you discover that consciousness itself is a doing. And then you stop doing that. Then what happens?
What word did he use? Seeing?
Sorry?
What word did he use? I thought he used. I have a question about is it another form of meditation? Is it reflective meditation?
Yes.
Where you maybe pick up, you know, something that you want to find out more about, and then what do you purposely think on that?
Right.
Does that have any relation whatsoever to, should it even be called meditation?
Sure. Well, meditation is a very general category. There's, you know, thousands perhaps of different kinds of meditation. And so that's why if someone say, you know, two people say, you know, they both meditate, they could actually be doing very, very different activities. And you have to ask them, what kind do you do? In the Buddhist tradition, there's a repertoire of various kinds of meditation practices. In Theravada tradition, kind of classically, kind of casually, sometimes say there's 40 different meditation practices, but there's actually a lot more. And there's also a whole slew of practices called reflective practices. Sometimes they're also they use the word mindfulness for it. For example, mindfulness of death, which is maranasati, is considered often considered a reflective practice where you contemplate some aspect of death. You're going to die soon, or you know, you spend some time looking at a corpse and you think about, oh yeah, just like this person has died, so it's the nature of all people to die, and at some point I will die. It's a little more reflective. Sometimes you'll pick a particular theme, sometimes it's a Buddhist theme, like impermanence, and think about what a good idea impermanence is. You know, how true, or, you know, just really study impermanence and see, you know, think about it and reflect on it in your life and its value in your life and its impact on your life. Sometimes you can reflect on a particular issue that's arising in your life, to sit down and meditate for a while, get it quiet and calm and centered, and then have a different way of thinking about something than you would in kind of street consciousness. From a very stable place, sometimes more creative, it allows for deeper intuition to flow. And so there's a whole, you know, there's a whole, it's very, very valuable. I do a lot of reflective practice, but not formally in meditation. I do it most often when I go for a run or when I go for a walk. Walking and running is a time for me.
At that point in time, it's okay to think. I mean, no, you're supposed to be in present. You're supposed to be aware, like, you know, be as present as possible. But reflective meditation, thinking would be like you were kind of going in the past, or you're...
That's okay.
So at that point in time, that's okay.
So this is an interesting topic that I don't know. I don't want to say I have the last word on this or the final understanding on this. So with anything, so don't, you know. I don't know. So don't believe anything I say. What I've noticed is that a fair number of people who spend a lot of time in the Vipassana circles in America, that to speak kind of casually, their God has become the present moment. with the understanding that if they're really going to be good in their kind of succeed in the spiritual life, they have to always be in the present moment. And so you must be in the present moment all the time, you know, in your meditation, outside your meditation. You're always supposed to be in the present moment. And maybe that's so, but I don't. The Buddha never said that, as far as I can tell. The Buddha recognized the tremendous value of being in the present moment and the value of not being lost in the past and the future. But the value of being in the present moment for Buddhists is not that the present moment is like the most wonderful thing possible. It's that the value of being in the present moment is the most valuable place where you can see how your mind works. And one of the ways to see it clearly, one of the ways to become free, is to practice this mindfulness practice, which is to be in the present moment very clearly. But you don't have to do it all the time. It's like it's a good idea, you know, to do some exercise on a regular basis. But no one expects you to exercise, you know, 24 hours a day or all your waking hours.
Don't you say in your you know, talks that try to be mindful throughout the day? I mean, this is the day long practice. I mean, it's not just here.
Sure. But you don't want to be, you know. So yes, it's very helpful to try to be mindful, and certainly most of us can do it really well by augmenting and developing our mindfulness through the day, but not at the expense of necessarily, not at the expense of giving up some normal and healthy parts of being a human being. So reflective practice is one of them. Sometimes I think about the past, sometimes I think about the conversation I just had with someone a little while ago to clarify what's going on. Sometimes I plan and think about the future. Sometimes I read the newspaper to find out what's going on far away from me. Sometimes I study the history of what's happened in the past someplace. Sometimes I ask someone else, what happened to you in the past? And all these things are very valid and useful things to do. What we're trying to do in mindfulness practice, in Buddhist practice, in a sense, is to, the ultimate point of Buddhist practice is to have a mind and heart which doesn't cling to anything. It isn't necessarily just be in the present moment. Be in the present moment is the vehicle to learn how not to cling. But once you're not clinging, mm-hmm. it's okay to think about the past or the future. So we want to be careful not to make the present moment our God. It just, you know, it's okay, we can just make it.
Not the end.
What?
It's not the end.
Being in the present moment is not the end.
That's not the point of the practice.
In a sense. Hopefully that wasn't, because that didn't make any sense. Nothing else makes sense. You know, just leave it here in the room. If anything, ever you hear anything from a Buddhist teacher that isn't, you know, not useful for you, either challenge it in your own mind, work with it for a while, or just, you know, abandon it. Yes, Carl.
It seems like in this practice that actually seems to be awfully busy, because one, you're supposed to be focusing on the breath. Two, you naturally sort of drift off, and then you're supposed to bring yourself, well, then you're supposed to label it, and then you're supposed to then bring yourself gently back to the breath. And that seems awfully busy.
It can be. It's one way of practicing mindfulness. But it doesn't have to be that complicated. It can be a lot simpler. And in fact, when mindfulness becomes mature, one does not have to use the breath anymore as a place to come back to as the anchor. The mindfulness becomes choiceless, where whatever is happening in the present moment becomes where what you attend to. So you might notice the mind has drifted off. If you notice that, you're aware of that. And you're just aware of that, and then if it disappears, the thinking mind, then you just awareness becomes like a sponge. It's opened, and it becomes aware of what next thing that arises. The next thing that arises might be the breath. It might be a sound. It might be an itch. It might be a feeling. It might be another thought. So there's not a you don't have to do something as much as notice what arises by itself into awareness. And that's called choiceless awareness. It's less of a doing. And that makes sense?
Yeah.
So on Thursday evening, where you tend to come most often, I tend Thursday evenings, the teachings and instructions have been tends to be much more basic, and I tend here because just partly because a lot of new people are coming in to emphasize the breath a lot. But if you go, you know, if you go on retreat, for example, then you'll find out that the breath is very helpful, but we practice much more choiceless awareness. Yes, please.
You mentioned that you teach a class on anger, handling anger. Let me give you like a 30-second of how you handle anger, because it is a natural feeling. It would not be right to deny it, but then how would you...
It's very dangerous to call anger a natural feeling. In a sense, everything humans do is natural. But that doesn't mean that it's healthy. For example, one of the things to do with anger is to study it carefully. And one of the interesting things that some people will discover is that anger sometimes is elicited, is stimulated by either fear or hurt. And if it's stimulated by fear or hurt, and you can recognize the fear or the hurt, if you recognize that first before it brings up the anger, then you're dealing with a whole different animal. And my suggestion is it's actually much more useful to deal with what's more primary, and the hurt and the fear would be more primary. If you're in the anger, you're already somewhat removed from the root of what the real issue is going on here. So one of the things mindfulness can do then is help you understand the anger well enough to understand what's under it, what's stimulating it. And I find in my own life that I'm much more skillful about how I negotiate life's challenges if I come from what's more primary, if I talk about or take into account the fear or the hurt, than if I respond from my anger. If I respond from my fear or my hurt, then the situation gets clarified much quicker. So if someone does something that hurts me, if I say, you know, if I get really angry at the person, yell at the person just shuts down or yells back or gets defensive. But if I tell the person, I'm really hurt, chances are the person's not going to close down then. They're much less likely to close down or attack me in return. So I find it much more useful to understand what's more primary. Does that make sense? So, let's, for this last few minutes of my attendance at Thursday evenings, let's spend 5 minutes doing nothing. So many thanks, everyone, and I wish you well over these holiday times. The solstice is tomorrow, and New Year's, and various sacred holidays we celebrate. The directions, if you want, for Redwood City Center is here, and hope to see you there.